Thank you, and take it away, Harlan.
All right, thank you. All right, so I have an hour for this, is that it? Okay, all right. We want to go back, as they used to say on the Cub games, all the way to King Solomon in Israel, Old Testament. He wrote in the Book of Solomon that he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no remedy for it. Notice I didn't say a cure, I said a remedy. In the 1640s in England, there was a doctor whose name was Dr. Trotter. Dr. Trotter, he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no remedy for it. In this country, in 1790, there was a man who was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. He was the nation's first Surgeon General. And his name was Dr. Benjamin Rush. And he wrote a paper in 1790 in which he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it and he had no remedy for it. The very first Vice President of the United States and the very second President of the United States, John Adams, had a son named Charles. And Charles was an alcoholic. And Rush treated Charles as best he could, but Charles died of his own alcoholism. And he came to the conclusion that alcoholism was a disease, was an illness. But again, Rush couldn't prove it, and he had no remedy for it. Ironically, Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's is a hospital in Chicago. But in the days of Dr. Bob in the 1920s, when he was a resident, it was called Rush Medical College. And the reason that it was called Rush is after Dr. Rush. And in Chicago, where I was born and raised, there is a street called Rush Street. Very sort of touristy street, a lot of very high-end restaurants, there, bars, things like that, places to dance, things like that. And Rush Street is named after Benjamin Rush. And in the 1920s, there was a neurologist, unconcerned with alcoholism, unconcerned with anything like that. And he was a neurologist, and his name was Dr. William Duncan Silkworth. And he had a friend named Dr. Charles Townes. And Dr. Townes owned and operated what was then the premier hospital in the nation for the treatment of alcoholism and drug addiction. It was named the Towns Hospital. And in 1929, on October the 29th, Black Tuesday, Dr. Silkworth lost everything he had in the stock market. And he needed a new job. And he went to his friend Charlie Townes, and Charlie Townes hired him as the medical director of Towns Hospital. And from 1929, November of 29, up until 1933, when he met Bill Wilson, 4 years had passed. Not quite 4 years, but 4 years. And he saw thousands of heavy drinkers, moderate drinkers, and alcoholics pass through the portals of that institution. And he started to develop a theory about these guys. And he started to develop a theory strictly on observation. None of this was provable scientifically. And what his theory said was that in certain, primarily men, but in certain people, there is at work a strange, strange obsession of the mind that is seeking out the effect. What is that effect? The effect is that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by eating, by drinking this liquor. And that that sense of ease and comfort quickly passes into drunkenness, because the physical allergy or the craving makes it impossible for the alcoholic to stop once they've started. But let's back up just a little bit. About the 1830s in this country, when the country was very young, the country was only 40, 50 years old at that time. There grew up in this nation the temperance union, the temperance movement. And the temperance movement were people, primarily women, who wanted there to be no alcohol consumed or sold or produced in the United States. And this was largely a Protestant movement against alcohol, largely a Protestant movement. Up along the time of the 1880s, there was a woman from Evanston, Illinois. Remember I mentioned Evanston, Illinois before, where I would go to meetings? Well, this is, woman was from Evanston, Illinois. And she, what her name was Carrie Nation. And Carrie Nation started the Women's Christian Temperance Union. She was arrested dozens of times for coming in and destroying taverns and their equipment and breaking the bottles, breaking the glasses with her hatchet. She was actually arrested many times. And they had a saying, "Lips that touch liquor will never touch mine." Lips that touch liquor will never touch mine. And this went on and on. In 1918, to take effect in 1920, was called the Volstead Act, the 18th Amendment of the Constitution. And the 18th Amendment of the Constitution prohibited the sale, manufacture, and distribution of liquor in the United States. And from 1920 to 1930, this was the law of the 1933, excuse me, from 1920 to 1933, this was the law of the land, was prohibition. And it was called the Great Social Experiment, and it failed miserably. But up until the time I was an adult, Evanston, Illinois was dry. You couldn't sell liquor or buy liquor in Evanston, Illinois when I was a young man in my 20s. Then there was a hotel that came in there and they were going to build, and the city of Evanston didn't issue liquor licenses. And this hotel chain said to the city, "If you don't give me a liquor license, we're not building in your town." And that's when it changed. I remember as a young man, not as a kid, but as a young man, when we would fly over Kansas, they would collect the liquor, because Kansas was a dry state. Up until not that long ago, Kansas was dry. And Kansas and Evanston were dry. I digress. 1933, liquor was back. The great social experiment had failed. And that's why you see a lot of things in the big book about the wets versus the dries and how we'll never get anywhere if you hate liquor, like that kind of thing. But anyway, I digress. In 1917, Bill Wilson went into World War I right after his marriage to Lois Burnham. And this took place in Vermont. It was a Swedenborgian wedding. This was their denomination, Swedishborgen. And they had this wedding, and off Bill goes to war. And he is drinking in England at the time. He lands and he sees, he's given cordials in New York. Cordial, I guess, is a mixed drink. So in 1917, he begins drinking. But he has been warned because his grandfather, on his father's side, his paternal grandfather, was an alcoholic. And it tore apart his life, and they didn't get divorced, but it wreaked havoc on their marriage. Bill's own father was an alcoholic. And in 1906, when Bill was 10 years old, his mother divorced his father. And this had a tremendous impact on young Bill. Tremendous impact on young Bill. Divorce was very scandalous in those days. Today, it's very common. Unfortunately, it's very common. I too am divorced, which I didn't want. I didn't file. My wife wanted to divorce me and she fell in love with somebody else. What are you going to do? But I don't like the fact that I'm divorced. I love my girlfriend now, but I don't like the fact that I'm divorced. It bothers me a little bit, but okay, fine. Well, Bill has been warned, but he wants to fit in. And what does he notice when he's drinking liquor? He feels like part of the world. Dr. Silkworth calls this the effect. And for compulsive overeaters, the unfortunate thing is drunk lasts a long time. High on drugs lasts a long time. The effect from food is about 9-10 seconds tops. Tops. And then the revulsion sets in. Well, Bill Wilson is drinking. And in 1933, through the kindness of his mother, who went off to Boston to be one of the nation's first osteopathic physicians, and his brother-in-law, Leonard Strong. Leonard Strong married Dorothy Wilson, who was Bill's sister. They put him in Towns Hospital. Now, he could have gone to Bellevue. He could have gone God knows where. He gets put into Towns Hospital, where he meets Dr. Silkworth. And Dr. Silkworth tells him that although you've been sick mentally and bodily and mentally, where the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to alcohol. And Silkworth explains to Bill Wilson that it remains strong in other areas. For 1 year, the goose hangs high and Bill stays sober. In April of 34, he is back on his ass in the Towns Hospital, and he is drunk. And Dr. Silkworth, now looking at Bill after he was gone, now he's back, he concludes that Bill Wilson is an alcoholic and that there is nothing that can be done for him. Nothing can be done. He tells Lois, you're going to have to give him up to the Undertaker or the asylum. Because there were three things that could happen to a drunk in those days. Insane asylum, jail, death. That's it. That's it. There was no other solution. Bill Wilson almost welcomes the idea. There's no more fight left in him. He has no more fight. He doesn't want to continue life as an alcoholic drinking. And he tries desperately to stop, and he cannot do it on his own willpower. He can't do it. Now, Bill Wilson is a strong, smart guy. A strong, smart guy. But he cannot fend off his desire to drink. Can't do it. He, on Armistice Day, after a period of sobriety, remember he went into the hospital in April of 34. Armistice Day is November 11th. He has been sober since getting out of the hospital. He's on a dry drunk. A dry drunk is what we would know as a diet. It's restricting your food on willpower, no recovery there, and it's a miserable way to live. Miserable. He's going golfing. Lois gives him money to go golfing. It's a beautiful fall day in November, November 11th, 1934. And he goes on the bus, and it's the end of the line where the golf course is. And a man gets on the bus with a rifle. Could you imagine getting on a bus today with a rifle? They lock you up. But this guy has a rifle, and he's going to the shooting range, which is also at the end of the line. Now, Bill Wilson was a schmoozer. He loved to talk to people. He loved people. And he strikes up a conversation with this man that's going skeet shooting. And the bus gets into an accident with a car. And they empty out the bus and they tell him, you got to wait for another bus. So Bill Wilson and this guy go into a restaurant bar. And Bill Wilson's sitting there, and he's not drinking. But he's telling this guy that he just met, you know, minutes before about his alcoholism and how he's been hospitalized twice. And this guy's listening. And listening. And then the bartender, who Bill describes as very Irish, I don't know how he got that, but he describes him as very Irish, comes over and he says, were you boys in the war? Meaning World War I. And Bill Wilson says, yes, I was. And the other guy says, yes, I was. The bartender sets two beers in front of them and said, boys, these are on the house. And Bill, after telling this man for a half an hour why he can't drink, why he can't live as an alcoholic, why it's no good, he drinks the beer down and he triggers the physical allergy and he is drunk as a skunk when he gets back to Lois. Now, this is in November of 1934. But let's take a look in our minds and let's go to Rhode Island. While we're in Rhode Island, we're going to look in on Roland Hazard. Roland is the son of generational wealth. His great, 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 great grandfather came to this country in the late 1600s, the late 17th century. And they own a company called Burlington Mills. And if you've ever walked on a carpet, you probably walked on Burlington Mills carpeting. They also are major stockholders in a company called Allied Chemical. These were wealthy people. And their wayward son, Roland, was very, very much up against it in his attempts not to consume liquor. He has himself sequestered on a Caribbean island. And the quartermaster, the one who brings him his food and other supplies, things like that, is told never to drink, never to bring him alcohol. So for 1 year, Roland stays sober. Roland comes back to Miami. Miami was how you got to Rhode Island. You first came to Miami, then you'd go up to Rhode Island if you're coming from the Caribbean. And Roland cannot stay sober because in Miami, they have bars and he couldn't stay sober. They have bars. Roland now seeks out the services of the fledgling art of psychiatry. He is thinking that he just doesn't know enough about his mind or how he thinks or acts. So he tries to get to Freud, who was considered the number one psychiatrist. He wasn't really a psychiatrist. He was more of a psychotherapist at that time. And Freud wasn't taking on any new patients. So he gets to Adler, and Adler is not taking on any new patients. And then he goes to Switzerland. I almost couldn't think, I'm so tired. He goes to Switzerland because the number three man of psychiatry is there, psychotherapy is there, Carl Jung. J-U-N-G is Jung. And he goes to Dr. Jung in 1931 and remains in Switzerland under the care of Jung in a hospital for 1 year. 1 year. He says to Dr. Jung, "What do you think?" And Jung says, "I think you're ready to go home, my boy. You seem fine." Roland, on his way back to America, has to go to Paris first. Paris is the gateway to the United States. You go there first, and then your next stop is New York. Roland goes to Paris and sees, while in Paris, two very, very wealthy friends of his parents. And they are there on holiday. And they say, "Roland, my boy, what are you doing here? What are you doing here?" And Roland says, "I am here, and I was under the care of Dr. Jung, and he got me sober, and I feel like $1 million. And they decide they're going to celebrate Roland's sobriety. And the only way they knew to celebrate anything was with champagne. They order a bottle of the best champagne they can get their hands on. And within minutes, Roland is drunk under the table, incapacitated. Roland goes back to Dr. Jung in Geneva, and Roland is informed that he is going to die or go mad. And Dr. Jung says, "I have misdiagnosed you. You are an alcoholic." Now, is it odd or is it God that Roland got to Jung? Because Freud and Adler believed that all solution lie within the mind, the cerebral. Jung broke rank with them and said, "Here and there, there are people who have had what are called vital spiritual experiences, and it alters their reaction to life, their emotions, attitudes, and thoughts." And Roland is informed by Dr. Jung that this may be his only hope. Is it odd or is it God that he didn't get to Freud or Adler, because Jung was the only one of those three that offered up a spiritual solution? Jung goes back to America, sober, but he doesn't want to go into a conventional church. And at that time in the 20th century, the Oxford groupers were not that old, but he believed he might find what he's looking for in the Oxford group. Abby is with them. No, we're not up there yet. Sorry. He believes he can find what he's looking for in the Oxford group. He meets a guy by the name of Shep Cornell and a guy by the name of Sebra Graves Jr. Sebra Graves Jr. and Shep Cornell have something in common with Roland. They are alcoholics and they're staying sober using the six tenets of the Oxford group. Tenets are what we would call today steps. And they're using these six steps to stay out of the liquor. Very, very important. Now, Roland is friends with them, and I want you to leave Roland alone for just a minute, and we're gonna go to Albany, New York. And while we're in Albany, New York, we're gonna look in on our friend, and his name is Edwin Ebby Thatcher. And Ebby Thatcher is an alcoholic, we surmise. He is an alcoholic. And as such, he is told by his family, who were very political, Ebby's father and brother became the mayor of Albany, New York at different times. There's a Thatcher Park in Albany after the father and the brother. Well, Ebby Thatcher is sent to the summer home in Manchester, Vermont. Manchester, Vermont is right across from East Dorset, Vermont. That's where he met Bill. They also went to school together at Barr and Barton. It wasn't called this then, but it was Barr and Barton Seminary. Now it's called Barr and Barton Seminary. But at that time, it was just Barr and Barton Academic or something like Academy. I think it was Academy, something like that. And Ebby Thatcher was on the baseball team as a child at Barr and Barton. And one of the kids that he met was Bill Wilson. Well, Ebby Thatcher is in Manchester, Vermont, and he's drinking. That's what alcoholics do. He's drinking liquor. And a pigeon lands on his wall that he's painting. So he does what any clear thinking person would do who's drunk. He goes and gets his shotgun and starts blasting the wall. And the police hear about this and they're not crazy about that. So they tell him, you blast the wall one more time, we'll make you clean it up and we'll arrest you. We'll put you in Brattleboro. Brattleboro is the insane asylum in Vermont. So Ebby Thatcher stops it. Sorry about that. I had to scratch that. So he had to, Ebby. He blasts these pigeons and they arrested him. And if you've seen Animal House, they put him on double secret probation. If you've seen Animal House, you know what I'm talking about. They give him a warning. If we have to come out here and arrest you again, you're going to Brattleboro. And Brattleboro isn't just a city in Vermont. It's where the insane asylum is. And he knows damn well that he's going to the insane asylum if he has any more trouble with the cops. August of that year, 1934. He is driving while drinking. He's driving drunk with liquor in the car that's open. He drives, Ebby drives right through a woman's kitchen. And the police come and arrest him because he gets out of the car, doesn't show any contrition whatsoever, none. He gets out of the car and says, "Hey, Toots, how about a cup of coffee?" She calls the cops. The cops come. And in early September of 1934, he is in a cell awaiting transfer to Brattleboro. Now, let's leave Ebby there for just a minute and let's go back to New York City. At the cavalry mission in New York, Sam Shoemaker is the rector of the cavalry mission. He is an Episcopalian clergyman, and Shep Cornell is there, and Roland Hazard is there, and Seber Graves Jr. is there. Three people who were alcoholics who are getting sober using the Oxford Group method, not of getting sober, of living. The Oxford Group, I want to be very clear, they were not concerned with alcoholism at all. They just had something that worked. Now, Ebby is in Vermont. Roland and Seber Graves Jr. are now embarking back to Rhode Island in early September of 1934 to stop in at the Hazard home. He wants to show his parents that he is sober and that he is doing his life. And they're just quelling. Quelling is a Yiddish word for rapture beyond belief. Rapture beyond belief. And Seber Graves Jr. says to Roland, "Hey, I've met your family. Why don't you come up to Vermont? I'm from East Dorset, Vermont. I'd like to introduce you to my family." Now, who else do we know that's from East Dorset, Vermont? Yes, that's right, Bill Wilson. He's from East Dorset, Vermont. And Seber Graves Jr. and Roland Hazard are on their way to Vermont in September of 1934. If they went a week later or a week earlier, there is no meeting here today. It had been canceled because none of us would be in recovery. They happen to be there the very week that Ebby Thatcher is about to be remanded to Brattleboro Insane Asylum for drunk and disorderly. Now, Roland Hazard and Seber Graves Jr., they hear about Ebby. Drunks know other drunks. They just know. They just do. And so they decide that they're going to go to the judge and ask the judge if the judge will give Ebby to their care so they can take him to the cavalry mission and see if they can help him with the Oxford Group. The judge in this case happens to be Seber Graves Sr. And is it odd or is it God that it was Seber Graves Jr. and Roland Hazard who just happened to be in East Dorset, Vermont that week? Is it odd or is it God? Now, Ebby Thatcher is brought to the judge's chambers and given a choice. He can either be remanded to the insane asylum in Brattleboro, or he can go with these men to the Oxford Group meetings in New York, and he will sign extradition papers that if he doesn't do what they say, he goes back to Brattleboro Insane Asylum. He signs the papers. Now the deal is you go with these, as Ebby called it, holy rollers. He didn't want to go with holy rollers, but he figured anything is better than the Laughing Academy. Now, he goes down to the Oxford Group in September of 1934. And from September to October, he is working the tenets of the Oxford Group movement. What are the six tenets of the Oxford Group movement? Number one, complete deflation. Number two, dependence and guidance from a higher power. Number three, moral inventory. Number four, confession. Number five, restitution. And then number six is testimony, which is go tell people what Jesus Christ did for you. They changed that to continued work with other alcoholics. So those are the six steps. I'm taking this from page 263 of the fourth edition of the Big Book. Page 263 of the fourth edition has these tenets of the Oxford Group movement. And there were the four absolutes: absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. Those are the four absolutes of the Oxford Group movement. Now, these guys, drunks, were having trouble being absolutely anything but drunk. But this is what the Oxford Group had. And Roland and Zebra and Ebby and Shep are staying sober. He goes to the Oxford Group, Ebby. Ebby goes from September to October is 1 month of sober. October to November is 2 months of sober. It's the first two-month period he's had in his life, in his adult life. And they tell him, you must go give testimony. And he said, I don't want to go give testimony. And they say, you don't have to. You can go to the insane asylum in Brattleboro if that's what you want. And he says, well, I think I'll go give some testimony. And he thinks and he thinks and he thinks and he thinks as to who he can go give testimony to. And he thinks of his old childhood buddy, Bill Wilson. Why was Ebby the perfect harbinger, the perfect conduit of this message? Because Bill knew that Ebby was a drunk. It wasn't some preacher trying to preach to him. It wasn't some holy roller trying to convince him not to drink. He knew that Ebby was an alcoholic, a drunk, just like him. Ebby used to say, Christ, if I ever get as bad as Bill Wilson, I'm going to quit. And Bill used to say behind Ebby's back, man, if I ever get to be as horrible a drunk as Ebby, I'm going to quit. Well, Bill Wilson never quit. And Ebby calls on Bill Wilson. And I got to cut this short because at 2 o'clock my time, we're done. So I want to get through the story. I want to get through everything. Ebby convinces Bill that this spiritual thing, this spiritual way of life, is what is going to do it for him. And the way that he convinces him is to exemplify it by living it. Remember the questions we had? There were two of them. How can I help my kids? The way you can help anybody is to show them your recovery. Nobody is interested in what you're saying. They want to see what you're doing. What you're doing is screaming so loudly, they cannot hear what you're saying. And Ebby is shocking Bill, shocking him by his sobriety. He was aghast. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now he's on fire all about religion and he's sober. He's sober. Now, Bill Wilson knew the disease, the mental twist, and the allergy of the body, but he didn't know there was a remedy for it. Nobody, Silkworth didn't know. Ebby Thatcher knew the solution, but he didn't know the problem. Ebby Thatcher didn't know about the allergy of the body. He didn't know about the twist of the mind. So in this one conversation, for Bill Wilson, everything came together. And a long story short is on page 12. At the moment of confluence, at the moment of nexus, he says, I saw, I felt, I believe. What did he see? He saw recovery. Bill Wilson had seen heavy drinkers, moderate drinkers, and alcoholics not drinking in the town's hospital, but they weren't happy about it. Now he sees Ebby, who's happy about this. He's happy in his release. He saw recovery. He felt hope. And what did he believe? He believed that God could and would help him if he were sought. There is nothing of this earth that created your compulsive overeating. Nobody is to blame for your compulsive overeating. Nothing that is of this earth caused you to become a compulsive overeater. And there is nothing, nothing of this earth that is going to cure you of your compulsive overeating. Your relief must come from a higher power. There is zero chance that anything that is of this earth is going to help you. Pills won't do it. Money won't do it. Doctors can't do it. Clergy people can't do it. You have a disease that only a spiritual experience or spiritual awakening will conquer. I'm going to say that one more time. There is nothing of this earth that is going to help you. Your relief, you have an illness that only a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience will conquer. What's the difference? A spiritual experience is sudden and profound, and a spiritual awakening is slow. That's the difference. For amplification, see Appendix 2, 567 in the fourth edition. For amplification, see Appendix 2. Long story short, Bill Wilson is going to get sober on December 14th, 1934, and he will stay sober throughout his life. And he will spearhead a movement that is in 175 countries, and it includes millions and millions of people who are yet unborn. The sun will never set on Bill Wilson's work. Was Ebbe a theologian? No. Was Ebbe an angel that God sent? No. Was Bill Wilson a philosopher, a theologian? But these men were perfect for what they needed God to do because they were drunks. And because they were drunks, they could speak and understand the language of the heart. And there were three things that Bill Wilson wanted to do: write a book, start a chain of hospitals, and have paid missionaries go through the country proselytizing their program. Thank God the only thing that happened was the book. Dr. Bob was not the first choice at a co-founder. The term co-founder was not around for years. He was just the guy in Akron and Bill Wilson. But he was basically co-founder because Ebbe got drunk in September of 35. Ebbe got drunk. And Fitzmaho was sick and died in 1944. And Hank Parkhurst, who had a lot more to do with the writing of the book than Dr. Bob ever did, was drunk by the fall of 39. So by default, Dr. Bob, who was the head of it in Akron, became co-founder. Ebbe had a better claim at co-founder than Bob. Hank Parkhurst had a better claim than Bob of co-founder, but he couldn't stay sober. And Dr. Bob died sober in 1950. Now, there's more to it. I have podcasts on it, and there's all kinds of stuff. But we're pushing time, which I never thought we would do. We are. In 1955, a man by the name of Jim Willis in Oxnard, California, started a group called Gamblers Anonymous. He knew that gamblers needed a place to go to identify that we're not alcoholics. And he started Gamblers Anonymous. And there was a show on television in California called The Paul Coates Show, C-O-A-T-E-S, The Paul Coates Show. And one day in November of 1958, there was a broadcast of five members of Gamblers Anonymous, including Jim Willis. And there was a housewife. It was one of these late night shows, you know, midnight, you know, 11 o'clock at night, midnight, whatever it was. And a housewife named Roseanne Scholar, Roseanne S., was watching. She had two little babies and a husband named Marvin. And Marvin had a friend who had a problem with gambling. And she thought that if they could take their friend to a meeting of Gamblers Anonymous, maybe it would help him. In late November of 1958, they went to a meeting of Gamblers Anonymous. And Roseanne sat in the back of the meeting and identified with what these people were saying right down the line. And Jim Willis happened to be in Los Angeles at this meeting of Gamblers Anonymous. And Roseanne said to Jim Willis, "Jim, do you think a program like yours with these steps could help someone like me with their food?" And he heard the pain in her voice and he said, "You know, Roseanne, I don't see why not." And in January the 19th, 1960, the very first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous took place in West Los Angeles, California. January 19th, 1960 was the first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. In Luling, Texas, there was a man named A.G. Ainsworth, big, tall guy. I can see him now. I can hear him now. And he was a compulsive overeater, and he went with his friend Robert to a church retreat that weekend. And Robert was a member of AA. And A.G. was looking for some way of getting relief for his eating problem. And they were coming back to Luling, Texas, and they were stopping at a German bakery to get some crap to eat. And A.G. said to his friend, "Robert, do you think a program," he didn't say program, he said a program. He was a Texan with a real thick Southern accent. I can see him now. "Program like yours would help somebody like me with food." And his friend Robert heard the pain in A.G.'s voice, because A.G. tried to make it sound like he was joking in case Robert made fun of him. He said, "A.G., I don't see why not." And in 1961, five groups of a new program called Gluttons Anonymous sprang up. A.G. contacted a woman by the name of Norma B., and Norma and A.G. Ainsworth founded a group called Gluttons Anonymous. And in Texas, there were five groups of Gluttons Anonymous by 1962. And in Los Angeles, California, and the Valley, there were 16 groups of Overeaters Anonymous. And they, the Gluttons Anonymous people one day called AA to find out if they knew of anybody that was using the steps and the big book of AA to recover from their eating disorder. And they gave him Roseanne's phone number. And on that Sunday, Norma and AG and other members of Gluttons Anonymous gathered to call Roseanne. And it was like Stanley finding Livingstone. AG flew his private plane to Los Angeles. And in 1962, he became the first man in OA. Not that men didn't want to get in before, but the OA's bylaws were it was for women only. No men were allowed in the meetings in those days. And AG became the chairman of the board of trustees. And in a vote of 16-5, we became Overeaters Anonymous. We filed paper with the Canadian and United States government as a tax-exempt charity, and we were on our way. Roseanne Scholar and A.G. Ainsworth were very instrumental in all those things, but there were others too. If you take out one link in the chain, Silkworth, Charlie Towns, Abby Thatcher, Dr. Jung, you take out Fitzmaio, you take out Jimmy Burwell, you take out any of these guys, any of these people, there is no program. There's no program. And that's why it's important that you become one of those links in the chain by recovering, and you can become part of that history by passing this message to people that are suffering today. All the people that I've named are dead and buried. None of them remain alive today. And the work they did is monumentally God's work. But God's got a job for me, and he's got a job for you. You can light these people up. You can, to the world, you're a person. To a person who is suffering, you can be the world. And I want to tell you a story about a guy who was not any bit of a founder or any historical significance, except what I'm telling you. I had a friend, he's dead now, and he was an alcoholic and a drug addict. His name was Scott. And he was also a compulsive overeater. But when he was working on a Saturday night at the AA office in Los Angeles, he went and ended up out in Los Angeles. A call came in, and it was a man in a motel in East Los Angeles. And the guy was drunk, and they always go out in twos. They go out in twos. So Scott and this other guy go out there, and they see this guy, and they're talking to this guy for an hour, but he's falling asleep. And they put him to bed, took his bottle, put the cork back on, and left. They were talking to this guy for about an hour, but he was falling asleep. 5 years later, Scott is speaking in San Diego at an Alcathon. And a guy comes up to him and throws his arms around him and says, "You saved my life." And Scott says, "I don't know you. Who are you?" And the guy says, "Oh, sorry." He says, "Do you remember several years ago, you came out to a motel in East LA and you talked to a guy at the motel, and you remember that?" And he says, "Yeah, I remember. That wasn't you." He says, "No, it wasn't. I was hiding under the bed and I heard every word you said, and I haven't had a drink since." Any idiot can count the seeds in an apple, but only God can count the apples in a seed. You never know who's listening. You never know what God is going to do with the message that you convey. You don't know that somebody who will never recover will tell something to someone who does recover. And there's your legacy right there. There's your legacy. That you made a difference in the amount of people that could live a free man or free woman and hold their heads up and be sober and abstinent and in recovery. This is a small piece of the history. There's much, much more. We don't have the time. We're going to close, and we're going to now do questions and answers for 20 minutes. And then I am going to go watch some basketball.
Thank you, Harlan.